In this part of the program, we'll be looking back to what has come to be called the Battle of Mogadishu. It took place on October 3rd in 1993 in Somalia. On that day, a planned 90-minute mission to capture a Somali warlord turned into a firefight that lasted 17 hours. 18 Americans were killed, 84 wounded, and perhaps as many as 1,000 Somalis were killed. These are the events that were dramatized in the book and the film Black Hawk Down. So maybe some of the people listening this morning have read the book or have seen the movie. This morning we'll be talking with someone who fought in that battle and is one of the editors to a book that has just come out. It's titled The Battle of Mogadishu, that brings together the first-hand accounts of six who fought in that battle. Dan Schilling is one of them. The book is published by Ballantine. It's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. Let me tell you a little bit more about him. His military career spans 18 years within the Air Force and Army Special Operations. He has received many awards for his service, including the Bronze Star with Valor, the Joint Service Commendation Medal, the Armed Forces Expeditionary Medal. He also, in addition to his military experience, is a professional demonstration skydiver and base jumper. He now makes his home in Utah, where he is co-founder, chief executive of Kokopelli Western LLC. It's a consulting and development firm specializing in post-secondary institutions. He's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you were where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you're listening, around Illinois, Indiana, or in fact anywhere in the United States, if you happen to be listening on the internet, you can use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Questions are welcome at any point. The only thing we ask of callers is they're brief as can be, just so that we can keep the program moving, getting as many different people as possible. But of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to call. Mr. Schilling, hello.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's a great morning out here.
Well, we appreciate very much you giving us some of your time. It's a remarkable book, I think. Speaking of someone who has no experience in the military, no experience in combat, it's riveting. I think that's a pretty good word to use, as I think that it gives you maybe some sense of what that would be like. I don't know what sort of feedback that you've gotten from other people who actually have found themselves in similar circumstances.
Well, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that. One of the reasons we finally wrote our book, which comes on the heels of Mark Bowden's book, Black Hawk Down, was there was just overwhelming interest in our story. And I was initially opposed to actually writing the book with Matt, who's a very good friend of mine. And he and our agent fought with me for a long time. I've done some other writing, and they fought with me to actually put this thing down on paper because I thought, well, it's actually been chronicled somewhere else and even made a movie of. And what is there to say? But it turns out that people are just fascinated by our experience as men who are involved in the actual gunfight. And I'm also almost at a loss as to why people are fascinated by that, other than the story is compelling itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I guess, one of the things that I wonder is, and I'm sure that people who have been in the military and have been in combat will read it and have one kind of reaction to it, and maybe part of the reaction will be, yes, I know what that's like because I've been there. But I guess I wonder what you think someone who has not had that experience and has not been anywhere near that, who would have no idea what it's like. I mean, what is it that you hope that someone like that would get out of the book?
Well, I think that's really the value of, if you distill this book down, the value it has is it contributes to Americans, I don't know about overseas, but people in America, it'll help them to understand what it's really like to go through the kinds of events or experiences that many people in the military face. Now, this is an extreme example because, you know, Somalia in 1993, it's a city of 1 million people, and to drop 200 guys in the middle of downtown Mogadishu where everybody is armed to seize some bad guys from a meeting place in the midst of their stronghold, that's different than the normal military experience. But if you want to understand how we feel, what we think, how we react, and sort of the aftermath that you're left with, doing it in a firsthand form actually allows people to get inside your mind a little bit more rather than pick it up secondhand from a professional writer. And that's really what we wanted to do, is help people to understand what these people are, what makes us tick, because we're not... These are generally speaking, very intelligent young men who are very driven. It's hard to get into these types of jobs. It takes a lot of training. The attrition rates tend to be very high, you know, 60, 80, 90% even, to get into a job like we have as a ranger or a combat controller or a special forces soldier. And we're often misunderstood by the greater public, I think.
Well, and I think that's an important and interesting point, because I certainly think that you're right, that there are a lot of people who, and unless you've been in the military, maybe you have family in the military, and particularly if you're someone who rightly, I think, says we should be very careful about how we decide to send people into combat.
You know? Absolutely.
We ought to be sure we know what we're doing as much as possible. You know, we ought to have a good open discussion about whether or not we're going to do this or not. But, you know, particularly if you're someone who has real reservations about the use of military force, then I think that it is difficult to understand people who would be willing and eager to put themselves in that kind of maybe eager is the wrong word.
No, I think that's a good. I think that's actually people who want to get into special operations combat units are. It's like being on a football team. In fact, I was listening to your show earlier about the Hubble telescope. Mm-hmm. Astronauts are very eager to get into space. They'll do something if they think it's worthwhile. They'll risk their lives. And the people who do this are. Have a very similar philosophy. We believe in what we're doing, and we're willing to go out and do it, and we want to go out and do it because I trained for 10 years before I went on a mission like this. I'd been in the first Gulf War previously, but this was what I had been training for. It was the culmination at the time of my entire 10-year career. So you want to do what you've been trained to do, what you hope for, and don't always get, and that's kind of the legacy, and I'll come to that in a minute, of our mission, is the chance to do something where you are contributing to the greater good. And that's what our mission in Somalia was in essence, to bring stability. There was no hidden agenda. There was no, you know, other interests that the U.S. had in Somalia other than a purely humanitarian effort. But of course, the legacy of this mission was, well, a lot of guys got killed, and a lot of people on the other side certainly were killed. And what happened in the end was nothing. We left Somalia within 6 months, never to return. No one's ever gone back from the United Nations either. And that's a very dangerous precedence to set. That's one of the things that's bothered those of us who went there. Mm.
Well, that is one of the things about what happened in Somalia. It started out to be one thing. It turned into something else. And because of what happened there and the reaction to it, then ever after, really, it has influenced the way that people here in the United States, particularly people in government, think about where it is we're going to be militarily involved, where we're going to send troops. And certainly in the immediate aftermath, some decisions were made here in the United States not to do some things that maybe we should have because of what happened in Somalia and because of the fact that people were killed, and some really disturbing images came out of that and came back to the United States, which just even added to people's hesitance about the idea of sending American troops into some place, even if the idea was peacekeeping and stabilization. You're not even talking about sending someone into a situation where we know we're deliberately going into combat. Even other kinds of situations where there might be a role for the military, at least after that, we said, no, we're not sure we want to do that.
Well, and I think there's even a bigger point, which is, as much of an adverse reaction was had here in America, the bigger problem that we created from our operation there was the public perception around the country, around the globe. It's because perception is reality. If people believe something, whether it's true or not, they're going to act on that. And the perception was, if America comes and gets engaged in armed conflict, and you kill some Americans, you can drive them out. They'll go away. And that was a lasting impression on people around the world, and many people attribute our mission, that one day's events, to the emboldening of Al-Qaeda's, you know, efforts to do the things that we've seen them do, some of which have been pretty successful from their perspective. And that's a dangerous, dangerous precedent. And that's, and it comes back to the need for people to understand, if we're going to commit troops to an effort and there's going to be bloodshed, and if you send troops of the nature that are in our book, there's going to be some bloodshed on both sides. No one's immune to that. You have to be prepared for the consequences that follow that action. And it's a very dirty business. It's not a pleasant or exciting experience to have.
Let me introduce again, for anybody who might have tuned in the last few minutes here, our guest for this part of Focus 580, Dan Schilling. He spent 18 years with the Air Force and Army Special Operations. He was one of those soldiers who served in Somalia back in the early 90s and took part in this event called the Battle of Mogadishu, the one that was dramatized in the film and the book Black Hawk Down. And now the six soldiers who fought and who had different experiences, different perspectives on this, have put together a collection of first-hand accounts of what they saw and what they experienced. And the book is titled The Battle of Mogadishu. It's published by Ballantine Books. Dan Schilling is one of the editors, along with Matt Eversman. And if you're interested, you can find the book out there in the bookstore. And, of course, questions are welcome as well. I expect now we're talking about events that happened now more than 10 years ago, and some people's memories are going to be a little fuzzy. I definitely want to talk about what happened on that day on October 3rd, but maybe before doing that, I should have you talk a little bit about what it was that you all were doing there in the first place.
Okay, be happy to. I mean, you know, and actually let me give you a very brief background. Of course, in 92, there was a extensive famine in Somalia, coupled with, you know, no centralized government. It was basically anarchy, and the only stability was formed along clan lines, which are very, very strong in Somalia and in many countries. It's not uncommon. The U.S. waded into that in an attempt to stave off the famine, which we did quite successfully. But the question became, well, what do you do post-famine relief to ensure that there'll be less of a likelihood of that happening again, or there'll be greater stability for the population, doing what at the time was called nation building? Well, into that vacuum now stepped several of these warlords who were all competing with each other for dominance. And one in particular, Mohammed Farah Adib, came to the forefront because he had killed 20 Pakistanis, about an equal number of Nigerians, a smaller number of Americans, and was causing a lot of consternation within the United Nations. Into that fray, the U.S. introduced a special operations task force, which was called Task Force Ranger, and that was us. It was a joint Army-Navy-Air Force task force. It was primarily Army, but there was a few Navy SEALs, and there was a few Air Force special operations guys, of which I was one of those. And our mission that led to the battle on October 3rd was to hunt down and collect, not to kill, mind you, but to collect Mohammed Adib and key lieutenants that were in his Somali National Alliance militia. And that was our intent in the summer and going into the fall of 1993. Mm-hmm. What happened on October 3rd was we had a mission came down. We had conducted, and this is the effects of time, I think we had done 6 raids prior to this. I think this was our 7th raid. But regardless, we had done a number of raids to pick up Somali National Alliance personnel, and we had been successfully whittling down that list, collecting these people and turning them over to the United Nations. On October 3rd, we had intelligence that there was a meeting taking place in the heart of Adib's stronghold, which is an area called the Black Sea in downtown Mogadishu. And the mission, in essence, was to go in the middle of the afternoon with a couple hundred American Special Operations troops and snatch these few leaders from a meeting they were having from within their stronghold in broad daylight and spirit them away, take them back to our facilities on the coast, and then turn them over to a seaborne platform. But in fact, that's what we did. What people tend to forget about this because the gruesome images really tend to overwhelm people and become the focus of what happened and the deaths that occurred around this mission. But the mission itself was a success. We went in there to pick these men up, and we did just that, and people often forget that. And it was a very difficult mission, and we're all very proud of the fact that we could do that.
Well, I guess the question that everybody always asks, and I'm sure that it's a difficult and complicated one, is on that day, 3rd of October 1993, what went wrong?
Well, not only is it a good question, it's a very appropriate question, and I don't mind that question. Part of what is often overlooked, especially in this age of technological superiority that the U.S. really does enjoy, is we think we have this omnipotence to do whatever we want and impose, even militarily, our will on any situation. And nothing is further from the truth. We do have the finest troops, I think, in the world, and they're the most capable, the best trained, and the best equipped. But the problem is, it's an equation. That's only one half of the equation. The other half of the equation is, you've got bad guys, and these were some very bad guys, on the other side who are doing their best to kill you. Now, they are working very hard at trying to shoot down helicopters, which they successfully did, kill Americans, which they did as well, and confound your efforts to accomplish your mission. You cannot predict what an enemy force is going to do. Anybody who's ever been in combat will tell you they don't do what you think they're going to do, and they're sometimes better at doing things than you might expect. That leads to changes, and no combat plan ever comes out intact. It always changes, and there's just no way to do anything precisely exactly as you want it to have happen. And that's what happened in our event. Now, one of the reasons it's so extreme is, again, this is a city of 1 million people, and most of them are armed, and a lot of these fighters had 10 years' experience in the civil war and anarchy that had been going on in Somalia for a decade. It's a hard force to fight.
Well, you were going into a situation here that I'm sure that is extremely difficult. It's an urban environment. It's not your city, so you're strangers. And it could be that you could easily get lost and not be sure where you were going. The spaces are very tight to negotiate. So there could be, as I know from having read your story, some streets or some alleyways that you might want to go down that you couldn't because your vehicle was too big. It wouldn't fit. You have people all around you shooting at you, but then there are also people who are non-combatants, and it could be very difficult to tell the difference between the people who were shooting at you and the people who weren't. Add all those things up, and it's a pretty impressive list of negatives, the kind of things that probably if you had your choice, you'd say, no, I don't want to fight in that kind of circumstance, but you had no choice. When there, and on top of that, there were difficulties with communication, and perhaps here and there were problems with, you know, who it is that was supposed to be in control, who it was supposed to be giving orders, battles are you do every as you say you do everything that you can to plan it, but then when the battle starts, the plan kind of goes out the window. You don't. It's hard to know what's going on, and given all that, would there have been anything that could have been done that would have changed the outcome?
Yes. In retrospect, the answer is always yes. But I think you've touched on something that I'd just like to reinforce for people who are listening, and that is to execute a mission like this is an incredibly, incredibly complex endeavor. It has many moving parts, all of which have to be precisely coordinated, and that communication process is critical. And that's a very unglamorous aspect of this, the coordination and the communication, but it's absolutely critical to success. And of course, I would say we were successful in that event. As to having more either equipment or troops, that's a very easy thing to do to talk about in a armchair quarterback sort of manner. But we had everything that we felt we needed to execute the mission because, in fact, the facts will bear that out. It would have been better had we had, as backup, some U.S. heavy armor in the event that we needed to extract people in the manner that we did. We did not expect to do that. And one of the secrets to our successes, and even on this mission, typically is we are so light in armor and in number, and so fast and so violent in action that that's what allows you to send 200 men into a city of a million people and do a mission like this, is you don't have a large, cumbersome force. It's very, in spite of the anarchy that people have read into our situation, it's your ability to react quickly and think about it and then act on that reaction and then execute a modified plan that allows you to come out successful. And we did that. But of course, it's still a very terrible, terrifying experience because people get killed. Mm. And that's the unfortunate part of this. We leave behind these, they're almost always younger families, and young men get killed in this line of work, and it happens every year. And there's not much you can do to prevent that, but that is what you struggle your whole career to try and manage.
We are at our midpoint here. We have several callers, and we'll start to get people into the conversation here. Again, let me just introduce our guest, Dan Schilling. He is the co-editor of a book titled The Battle of Mogadishu, First-Hand Accounts from the Men of Task Force Ranger, about the first-person accounts of six soldiers who fought in this battle October 3rd, 1993 in Somalia, the book published by Ballantine. That's the events, if you have read the book or seen the movie Black Hawk Down. That's the battle here that we're talking about. Dan Schilling was in the military for 18 years with the Air Force and Army Special Operations. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, we just ask people to be brief so that we can keep moving along here through the remaining 25 minutes of the show. First up here, we have a caller in Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Point taken. I'll try. I'm trying to recollect if Bush 1 introduced this humanitarian mission, as you called it, in the last days. It was a lame duck or before that, but it's pretty clear that it wasn't, I don't think, entirely motivated as just a humanitarian mission. If you look at the U.S. force projection into the Middle East, U.S. had to rely on Diego Garcia, which has a British base, or AF base there, I guess. And putting yourself back in the time of the last days of the Bush administration, mm-hmm. last decade of the Cold War, it wasn't clear that Britain would have been entirely reliable ally for a project of force projection into the... So I really think that it's grand area strategy, and Somalia is close to the Horn of Africa. There's the other part of it, which was that Siad Barre, who was the head... warlord, had flipped from being allied with the so-called Eastern Bloc and was a U.S. ally in the last days of the Cold War. Maybe he knew something that the CIA didn't know, and changed his bet. So it had some small, maybe they would call it lily pad now, operations there. So I just don't accept on the face of it that this was some kind of humanitarian gesture at the end of Bush 1's administration.
Okay, I think that's a very good question. Siad Barre was actually out of the equation. He had been deposed already by this time. He was no longer a factor at all.
Clearly, I realize
but
that.
And it was, of course, started by the first Bush presidency. I will tell you, as a military guy, not a logistician, somebody who does all the support for this, that Somalia is an incredibly poor choice for a staging area. It is in fact the Horn of Africa, but there was never any plans for the U.S. to introduce a large force there to sustain operations, even as a lily pad. In fact, one of the reasons we did not have all of the equipment that so many people have made a big issue over, and in fact led to Les Aspin's resignation, was the desire to keep a very minimal footprint in Somalia so that we could actually extract ourselves from the country and make it less of an international sticking point. That was a very big concern. As one of the people who helped plan this mission from the early stages, not the humanitarian effort, but the effort to actually stabilize things and work on combating the, some people would call, terrorist element there, that was a major concern because they did not want to establish a permanent or large presence in Somalia. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well,
I don't believe that it was.
I don't accept it because Diego Garcia was quite pivotal in the long-range flights and those sort of things. Now, everything could have been done otherwise, but I think it was part of the contingency plan, since the Horn of Africa is, so close to the Persian Gulf, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as far as the bad men you were fighting, it was a failed state, and the Cold War has a lot to do with why that happened. But the number of people that were killed, as you say, it was the whole city was armed, and it wasn't a situation where you were a small light force fighting a concentrated or a top-down controlled warlord. One of them, the whole city was against the U.S. Presence by that time, and that's why so many of them were killed, and that's why you weren't really in the position of fighting a small group, it seems to me.
Well, I can assure you, as much of a not, it's divided. Mogadishu is divided along clan lines, very clearly delineated geographical clan lines. We were operating within the Habergetter clan, which is where this operation took place. Now, they have a very strong top-down organization as far as their ability to mobilize forces. But you have to introduce into that all these variables that are uncontrolled. And, of course, there was a lot of hostility towards the U.S. I would tell you that's misplaced because, again, we moved there, and this isn't subjective. We stopped several hundred thousand people from starving to death. That's a very honorable thing to do. I don't think anybody would refute that. And I do really disagree with your belief that this was going to be a long-term staging area for the U.S. If it was, we'd still be there now. But Diego Garcia was never under threat. We still use Diego Garcia to this day, and we'll continue to do that for the long term. As for the sheer numbers of people, it doesn't matter how well they're controlled. If in a street fight, which is what this was, at the basic level, this is a street gunfight. Just having sheer numbers of people, and I'll tell you, they were countless, makes it almost impossible to do what you think you need to do. And it's a very, very challenging situation to walk into. But in fact, there was a lot of organized resistance, and they had a very strong infrastructure because it's along clan lines. These people are all related to each other, and it's very effective. It's more effective in some respects than a traditional military made up of people who don't know each other when they first come into the military, because it's all family.
I'm going to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. We do have some other folks I want to get in, and we'll go next to another caller. This is someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. My comment is more in the nature of a quibble. You use the term, and it's frequently used, bad guys. And I object to this as an oversimplification and one that tends to get us into lots of trouble. It's a shorthand, and I'm sure you're using it that way, for our enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And our enemy may very well, and usually does, intend to do us great harm. However, they may not necessarily be bad or evil, and this shorthand tends to create a situation in which people see things as black and white, and good and evil, and it makes it very difficult for us to deal with these situations. Witness North Korea today, and perhaps sadder in Iraq. We may in time have to deal with this man, but if we've convinced everyone he's evil, it may be very difficult to do that.
Well, and I actually, that's a great point. As I don't view anybody in Somalia as evil. Did I view them as bad guys? I do. That, and you're right, it's an oversimplification that helps with brevity in conversation. But in fact, the people who were running the Habergetter greater objectives, which were, they were using starvation as a weapon. I will tell you, that is also a fact. And they killed, they didn't just kill, they ambushed a very unsuspecting Nigerian force on one occasion and killed, I think the number was about 18. On another occasion, they ambushed and killed an unsuspecting Pakistani force and killed 24 people. Those are bad. People who do those sorts of things, which was unprecedented at the time in the country, are bad people. And we were sent there to collect those folks. I wouldn't characterize them as evil, though. You're correct. In fact, I have as a man whose profession has been armed combat, I have a great deal of respect for Somalis because it turns out they're very good fighters. Now, many people would misunderstand that, just like you would say people misunderstand and you say bad, and they equate that with evil. When I say I respect them as fighters, that says one person who is bent on a certain objective, in my perspective, on their, and to them, equally important, bent on their objective. But one of the great strengths of U.S. forces is we have a very, American fighting forces have a very strong sense of what is right and wrong. Ask anyone who survived World War II, when U.S. troops came into an area that was previously occupied by foreign forces, Nazis or whomever, Americans brought chocolate. They didn't bring rape and torture as a general rule. There's always exceptions to everything. But Americans have a very strong belief in supporting other humans, and people in the military almost universally feel that that's part of their responsibility. I know that wasn't quite your question, but I just sort of threw that in there.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I'm sorry. I have to follow up on the bad guy question because I find it very distressing when people are brought in to explain things and then they start talking about bad guys, mainly because it's a childish expression, and I feel like they're talking down to the public. And as you talk more and more, it's really clear you know the intricacies of this. So I don't understand why you're using the term bad guy with a group that we don't need a code, we need an explanation. And I'm wondering in my mind if this is partially what went wrong, that when you went over there, the planners were still thinking in terms of bad guys and not in terms of the real intricacies of the political situation, and perhaps couldn't really plan and strategize well. It just baffles me why you would use the term bad guy when you are obviously on a mission to explain things, and you obviously know the explanations. You're really clearly a very intelligent man.
Well, my job in Somalia, this is where this may be challenging for you, but I'll tell you exactly what I think. My job in Somalia as a member of a special operations task force was to remove an element from the equation that was causing the greater United Nations efforts a great bit of frustration. And when people are actively planning to kill you, and then trust me, well, you don't have to trust me, this is my opinion. When people are trying to kill you and they have slaughtered other people and they have used starvation as a weapon against their own people, some of those people are, in fact, bad people.
Yes,
now, you may disagree with that.
You're explaining this to us, and you are no longer in that situation. It's 10 years ago. You thought over the whole situation, and you're explaining it to the general public, who needs to know exactly who you're talking about, not this universal bad guy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That, my problem with it, not the fact that in battle you use the term bad guy. My problem is that 10 years later you're talking to a general public and you're on a mission to explain what happened, but you're using a term that is confusing rather than explanatory. And I just really would ask you to reflect on the continued use of that. But my question is, why were the Americans so hated? I know the Canadian forces, the Canadian government had to do an inquiry after the Somalia incident because there were charges of racism and abuse of the Somalis. The American forces were clearly hated. And do you think that there was the same problem of racism towards the Somalis? Or, let's go back to that bad guy thing, perhaps that term was used too broadly and perhaps too many of the general population was hurt and therefore they began to hate the Americans as well. But do you have an idea now why, or have you rethought about why you were so hated by the general population?
If you are trying to stabilize a situation, and this is a complex issue, but I will do my best. If you're trying to stabilize a situation where there are people opposed to what you are trying to establish, you're going to start to build some resistance. And if you do anything, the longer you stay in a country and continue to try and interject either some stability or another perspective into the situation, you will begin to build resistance. And it could have been, if you removed America from the equation and inserted Great Britain or Australia, some other country that has similar views on democracy and human rights, which we really do, the longer you stay involved in somebody else's mess, the greater the likelihood that resistance will build against you. I think it's almost an inevitable thing. It's a very, very difficult situation to go into. And the longer you're there and do not come up with any resolution, the greater the resistance is going to be, until it doesn't matter who you are, from what country, representing what agenda, even if it's been helping, even if it's stopped just a few months previously, mass starvation, people will come to resent you. Well, and that's one of the challenges with doing this. Nation building is something, there's a reason you don't hear the term nation building anymore. And that reason is, it doesn't work that way.
When you insert Canada in the equation, the reasons why the Canadians were hated was because there were charges of racism against them. So, I mean, you can say that in this case there was a specific charge. And I'm just wondering, given the American history and American present, if this was also a problem with your troops.
No, it wasn't a problem with our troops, but I don't think. But then I would say to you also, in response to that, it was not a problem with Canadian troops. It may have been a problem with some Canadian individuals, maybe even some of the military leaders who were involved. And I don't recall all the details of that. But so I don't think, just as you say to me, this broad term about bad guys, I don't think you can say bad Canadians, because you're talking about a few individuals. And the greater Canadian effort was also there. But the Canadians were there to help Somalia as well, were they not?
I'm not talking about bad Canadians. I'm talking about a charge that required an inquiry by the Canadian government. And those are people who certainly are not doing it because they consider their own citizens bad guys. I'm talking about a specific charge.
That's right, you are.
I'm trying to find out why Americans were so hated. I mean, there was true hatred in the reaction to that incident. And that doesn't happen overnight.
No,
and there's
that's
a
my
reason
point.
For it.
It builds. The longer you are there and you are trying and you step in between fighting factions, it's one of the problems with any United Nations operation. When you step in between two fighting factions, both sides are going to come to hate you. That's human nature. And it's one of the difficulties of trying to do things like this successfully.
Well, thank you for attempting to answer my question.
All right. Well, thanks.
Hopefully it helped.
I wanted to ask you, in your section of the book, you tell the story about an earlier mission that you were on, where you were out and you were in your Humvee, and on the vehicle there's a 50-caliber machine gun mounted, and there's a guy, and in this case his name was Mike Pringle, whose job it was to shoot that gun, and who was very, if anybody was going to be shooting at you, this guy was going to be very exposed.
Yes.
So you tell the story about the fact that you were in a fight, there was some shooting, and you were coming out of this, and the guy calls down to you, Mike says, "I think I got shot in the head." And you said, "Do you want me to look?" And he said, "No, I think I'll be okay till we get back to the base." So you get back and you took a look at the guy, and apparently what happened was a bullet had come straight at him, had hit the edge of his helmet, had splintered. A piece of it flew off, and a piece grazed the side of his head. And it turned out he was okay. And afterwards, you said you kind of made a joke out of it. You called him One Inch because you figured an inch one way or the other way, the guy would have been dead. So here's my question. And if that happens to you, I guess I'm not thinking so much of you, but I'm thinking about of this guy, Mike Pringle. Something like that happens to you. How do you go out again the next day?
Well, part of the mechanism you use to continue to do those things, you've already touched on it. You take on this sense of humor that can be a bit bizarre. To people not involved in the situation, it seems very bizarre. But to us, you're in a bizarre situation. And so the attempt to find humor is a very good coping mechanism, you know. Gallows humor is very common in any kind of situation like this. It actually helps you to adjust because when you have an experience like that, you recognize how very little control you have over your own fate. But the desire to not let your teammates down, these people who mean as much or in some cases more to you than people you have blood relations with, drives you to do things that you would not otherwise do. But so many of these people who are in this line of work have already demonstrated that ability. It almost become, because by the nature of our training, just to get where we are, it's this need to make sure that you don't let the people down who are relying on you is more powerful than self-preservation. And that's not something I say lightly.
I guess one of the things I wonder is, having had that kind of brush with death, when you then go out into your next fight, do you feel more vulnerable because you know how close a call you had, or do you somehow feel less vulnerable because you live to tell the story?
I think it's both, and I think it changes from sometimes hour to hour and sometimes moment to moment, depending on what's going on. Because in a gun, it's not all sheer action. There are lulls. I mean, there are ebbs in the flow, and there are certainly peaks where it's just, you know, the volume of fire and what you're doing is all consuming. So that what you have to focus on is that important task at the time. Everybody has a job to do, and you're trained well enough. It's kind of Pavlovian to people who don't appreciate what we do. They think, well, you're just mindless automatons. But there's some truth in that you can overcome this strong urge for self-preservation to do what you have to focus on, whether that's to fire a gun, whether it's to talk on the radio, whether it's to give someone medical treatment or run out into the street and pick them up in the face of withering fire, which several guys have done. It's this need to make sure that you can take care of these people who are so important to you. And it takes a certain amount of experience and training to get to that point. But it's beneath that, at the basic level, it's this overpowering urge to not let anybody down.
Well, I think that's probably an important thing for people to understand. Again, for people who haven't been in the military and haven't been in combat, you ask why it is that soldiers fight. Well, they fight for what they believe in, and they fight for their country, and they fight for whatever the mission is, and they fight to achieve whatever the objectives are. Yeah, all that's true.
Right.
But at the end of the day, what they're doing is they're fighting for each other.
And it's absolutely true, and it's a universal human experience. It transcends race, it transcends nationality, it transcends gender. It comes down to being human, and it's a very important aspect of being human.
We have maybe about 10 minutes left, actually a little bit less, and our guest is Dan Schilling. He is in the military for 18 years with the Air Force, Army Special Operations. He served in Somalia and was part of Task Force Ranger, and that was the group that took part in this battle, the Battle of Mogadishu. And that's the title of the book that he has edited and also contributed to, a set of first-person accounts of soldiers who fought in that battle, October 3rd, 1993, that battle that was dramatized in the book and the film Black Hawk Down. Published this book, though, we're talking about here, that Dan Schilling is involved in, is the Battle of Mogadishu. That was published by Ballantyne. It is in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. 333-9455 is the number for here for Champaign Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Ken, I guess when you talked about the fact that when you had gone to Somalia that you had been training, maybe not specifically for that mission, but that you had been training to be able to do that for 10 years. Can you ever, though, really train and once you get into it, it can be what you thought it was going to be? I mean, is any amount of training really going to prepare you for what it's like when people are shooting at you?
No. Yeah, that's a very quick answer, but the answer is no. Because it's like saying, you know, you can talk about a car accident all your life and prepare for how to handle a wet, slick road, but are you ever prepared for the aftermath of having been in a car accident? I use this analogy because it helps people to understand. If you've been in a car accident, which many people have been, nothing you have prepared for actually, none of your preparation actually is adequate enough to get you through that experience. And you're stuck with the aftermath of what you have done. It's not an easy thing to have been involved in combat. You live with the consequences the rest of your life. I certainly do. Now, I think what I've had very honorable service, but it's hard to deal with having been a veteran of a conflict that has cost people lives and even friends of yours. But you do it the best that you can by practicing things as realistically and as often as possible, in order to be prepared for that first engagement. And it's often been said it's easy to get people to go into combat for the first time because of so much has been written or the perception, whether real or imagined. But to get them to go back a second time is really the challenge, because it's not a pleasant experience.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. Champagne here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Something that our speaker said disturbs me greatly, and that is, while I accept that it is very human to be able to band together in this fashion and to put rational thought aside, I don't see that as actually one of the better attributes of being human. The idea that you are able to brainwash people into sacrificing themselves to murder other people strikes me as one of the most horrifying aspects of our species.
Well, it's a survival instinct as well. If your species is under threat if you are a part of a small clan of people and you're under threat from a pack of wolves, your ability to band together and fend off those wolves and kill them and eliminate the threat to the rest of your, what you assume to be humanity, is an honorable thing.
If it's a clan versus wolves, yes, but if it's one clan versus another clan, your arguments fall on deaf ears.
I don't think so. What if it's my clan versus your clan and you are very aggressively trying to kill me? If I am trying to defend myself, my ability to band together with other members of my clan to defend myself, and I would say, if you want to put it into context, our ability to introduce stability for the greater number of Somalis is a great thing to do. There's nothing wrong with that. And armed conflict...
That's exactly what the other clan is saying as well.
Yes, it is. And guess what? Armed conflict is part of the human experience. If you go back throughout all of archaeology and you dig up the earliest tools of man, if you substitute the word tool for weapon, you'd be correct 100% of the time. It's a natural part of existence. There's conflict. And sometimes when conflict comes, you have to introduce people who will try and stand up and will engage in combat. And it's not a pleasant experience, but sometimes it's necessary, I would say. And you can disagree with me, and that's one of the great things about being in this country is this country defends democracy and your ability to disagree with me, even though I was in the military. In many countries, you don't have that right. I'm very proud to have been somebody who's defended your right to disagree with me. I take great pride in that.
I'm
glad that you defended my right to do that so many thousands of miles away.
Well, I don't have the... Here's the problem with being in the military. I don't get to choose where I fight. My leaders that you have elected for me have to make that decision, and hopefully you, as a voter, have chosen wisely to not put my life at risk. But I will still risk my life for you.
We're at the point where, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to finish now that we're getting maybe at some of the most difficult and interesting things we might discuss. We're simply going to have to stop. I want to, though, say thank you, Dan, very much for giving us some of your time today, and we appreciate it. And I know you did want to say real quick about what you were doing with the proceeds from the book.
Yeah, if I could, David, thank you so much. One of the reasons we wrote this book is so many guys get killed doing this line of work. They leave behind children who are not likely to go to college. We provide college educations for children who have lost their parents in special operations. Any readers or listeners who are interested, they can go to specialops.org, and they can see it's a 501c3 organization, or it's also in the index of the book, and it really makes a difference for these kids to get a college degree. But thank you so much for the interesting questions and for having me on the show as well.
Our guest, Dan Schilling, he is the co-editor and one of the contributors to this book we've mentioned. It's titled The Battle of Mogadishu, First-Hand Accounts from the Men of Task Force Ranger, published by Ballantine Books, describing that battle in Somalia of October 1993. And if you have seen the film Black Hawk Down, that's the battle there that's dramatized here. But this are people who were in the battle talking about what it was like, first-hand accounts. And again, it's out there in the bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it.